With that in mind, you and you, I mean, I sort of viewed Windstar as sort of a passion project between you and John. How did Windstar start?
Well, traveling on the road with John, we spent an awful lot of time together. We shared a suite together. We would ride in the limo together. I was his man and his confidant. And I also worked with him in meditation and worked with him in some of these energy ideas, because John really wanted to, he wanted to reach people. When we went to a place like Madison Square Garden, and it would be a full house, 44,000 people, two shows. John was the guy, first time, who said, "Tom, this is my first really big tour. This is 76, I think now. In place like Madison Square Garden, and I want to do it in the round. I want to have this little thing that swings around in the middle of 22,000 people, in which it's only 2 feet high, and I want it to be in a circle." And I said, "John, how you really think, given the way concerts are set up, you're on a stage, they have a big barrier, they have all the big guys with the big t-shirts on, throwing guys who are trying to get over the barriers back, and that's how the concerts are run, and that's how they were always run." And he said, "I want to do it different. I want to make it like a campfire." And we had a long conversation about that, and that's where the whole idea of the energy idea came in. And I said, we said, "Listen, you can make it like a campfire if you really absolutely believe that nothing's going to happen." And I said, "To do that, we're going to need some security around the stage." He said, "Oh no, Tom, no. To make it happen, only you is going to be in the first row. I don't want any uniformed people. I don't want any cops, just the regular cops in Madison Square Garden in the way in the back. I don't want to have any of that happen. I want you to take care of anything that's going to happen on the stage." I went, "You got to be shitting me, John, because
Wow.
I mean, I can't. My imagination now is running wild. I'm going, well, okay, I'm sitting there, some guy, and it's you could jump on the stage from any angle." I said, "This, I could be on one side of the room. I'm going to be right there. It's a revolving stage. I can't rotate around the stage with you. I've got to sit there. And what happens if it comes from the back?" He said, "Well, I know you'll be able to handle it." And that's all that was it. And I said, I'm screwed. This is
That's a heavy
something's gonna
burden.
happen here." Yeah, well, that's what I tried to impress on him. I mean, what's that gonna look like? But he said, I totally trust." And I said, "All right, we're going for it." So I started by, really preparing John, which was great. I said, "It's gonna be like a campfire. You're gonna reach the furthest person in Madison Square Garden. You're gonna all the way to the back. You're gonna reach him because," and he had that ability. He had the ability to really create that energy. And then we're gonna create that energy with the band, talking to them. It's all gonna be, and John's music obviously did not invite that it wasn't
right.
a rock concert, so we had that going for us. But this is New York City, and everywhere else we played, in which there were the biggest coliseums we could find all over the country, somewhere there's going to be a crazy so I decided, all right, that's great. And then I arranged to have a meeting with all of the facility people, the cops, the ushers, everybody, before each concert. And I would sit down and I would give them a talk. Anything ever happened like that. They just were workers coming in to work that night. And I got them together and I said, "Listen, John wants you to know that this is going to be a campfire experience. And you are the actors in that. You are part of it. You're not an usher just handing out a ticket and then, or a cop just looking to take somebody down. We want to create that environment from the time they walk in. We want you to be smiling to them. You say, 'Hey, have a great night.' All this stuff." We said, "It's so important to us because this has never been done before. A rotating thing, only a couple of feet high in the middle of all those people." And they actually got excited. I didn't believe it, but they got actually excited by it because now they were doing something besides just their job. They were part of a theater event. And damn, it worked. I mean, it worked everywhere we went around the world. There were a few times. No one ever got up on the stage except one time in the Hollywood Bowl. I wasn't allowed to do my thing because the vice president of the U.S. was there. So the Secret Service said, we're handling this. You're no longer involved with the security on the stage. And that's the only time somebody got up there. I mean, I watched it, you know. I said, oh, fuck. A guy got up there and a couple guys got him right away and took him off, you know, and it wasn't a big deal, but it was, you know, John and I, just, you know, we laughed at that and just said, well, there you go. You either believe it, you do it, or you act like security guys act. And that was the only time. So it was amazing all over the world. You know, of course, you had to remove some guys that were, and then we did that properly. I would be on the phone. They would give me a call on my headset and say, we got a problem back in such a section. And I said, okay, no cops, nothing. Let me just handle that. And then we, you know, go in and talk to them. And although in Germany, the guy didn't speak English, so that was tough. I had to put a technique on him to get him out of there. And I told him I would in English. He could understand a little bit, but I couldn't understand him. And he was, you know, so that was a great experience. You know, being with John was phenomenal. The work that he did was beyond his music. He was fully committed.
What's interesting is there's a sort of a tie in here with WinStar with all this stuff that you're talking about. And how did it really start? What was the seed that started WinStar back in the day?
Well, there are just numerous seeds. We'd be on the road somewhere and something would happen. Well, basically it happened, I would say, in conversations, you know, to and from in the limo at, you know, after a concert, sitting around having a beer, our hearts would spill out to one another. And we both had this incredible vision that something needs to be done in this crazy world. There's got to be somewhere we could create something that would support people. Not that we were trying to save the world, just that we wanted to do our part. John had started the Hunger Project. He was very much involved. He was the guy who, I mean, created in a big way the whole information around hunger. Went to Africa, went to India, worked really hard. He wanted to do so much more. Everywhere he went, he wanted to do something that was very positive. The environment was always part of our conversation. Jacques Cousteau became a friend of John's and had John out on the boat. And John is out on the boat. And you know a song, Calypso? I don't know
if
you...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he sang that at the high school, I remember.
Well, he came on the boat with Calypso, with Jacques. And after he was, of course, blown away by Jacques Cousteau, he said, do you mind if I go out on the bow of the boat just by myself? I just have some ideas I want to write down, maybe for a song. And Jacques said, of course, John. And you know, Jacques was hilarious. And John goes out there and he wrote the Calypso within that, I'd say, an hour period on that boat.
Wow.
And came back, and that was a song. It took him years to write other songs, but that song.
Was my favorite when I was probably, I don't know, 8 or 9.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I remember there's a picture that I think Mary Espa Hayes took at the Def Camp picnic,
where
a bunch of kids and I would go up and catch tadpoles and frogs and, you know, not really pay much attention to what was going on, you know.
Yeah,
but
right.
That song came on and I ran down the hill and I jumped up on the stage right next to one of the stage monitors. Probably half deaf today whatever. But that picture, it was in the paper and all that. And
that's great.
It reminds me of that because I do remember it was that song I was up there listening to. jump yes. down afterwards. Otherwise, I probably would have been deaf. But
yeah,
yeah, love that. Love that song.
Well, so that's sort of all right. So Jacques goes in his way. He goes, Jean, you've got to get with the humpback whale. Your life will be changed when you get with the humpback. So Jean said, holy shit, Tom, we gotta do something. And so Jacques helped us. We got a boat. We got the film crew, everything. And we're out in off the Big Island in Hawaii. This is 76. And humpbacks, you know, first of all, they're really big. They're 50 feet long. They're 50 tons. You get in the water with one of those, that's a scary idea. It, you know, that's just a big, because they could make one little mistake with their tail and you're a dead person. So the idea, of course, is John's going to get in the water with the humpbacks and get very close, and it's going to be really an incredible piece of footage. And off we are in Hawaii, and we're about a mile to offshore, and the hump, you find them through echolocation. You know, we got our hydrophones in the water, and we think we have them, and sure enough, there's three of them out there, the mother, the baby, and the male nurse, and they're just sort of playing around as they do in Hawaii, and this is going to be great. So John slips out in his dive gear. We had tanks that didn't have bubbles because Jacques Cousteau knew that bubbles bothered them. So we had this recirculating tanks or whatever they're called. And John and the filmmaker, cameraman, goes out, and they're about maybe 50 yards or so from the boat, which is just little bobbing heads now is all we're little seeing. And we're seeing these whales, and they're not moving. Usually when you're with a humpback, they will move. You'd be in the water and they just go by you. That's all. They just go by. They wouldn't hang with you. Well, these guys are hanging with John. Like, they're literally, feels like they're there. They're there to be with John. And the cameraman, we're thinking, oh man, the footage has got to be phenomenal. And then somehow John gets between the mother and the baby. The mother starts waving her tail, her body, in what looked like to be a very aggressive way. John and Katie Payne were zoologists out of New York University who were the experts of the humpback whale at that time. And they were on board the boat as our resident experts. They said, this looks very aggressive behavior. A lot of splashing is going on, a lot of turbulence. You know, John could be in danger. Let's get him back. So we're all waving for him to come back, but it's 50 yards. He doesn't see us. We don't know what's going on. And so Payne goes to me, Tom, would you go out and get John? I go, you talking to me? Of course. And I said, yeah, of course. I got my dive gear. And Dan McSweeney, who was a resident whale expert in Hawaii, and he also would go up to Glacier Bay and research them when they were feeding, he said, Tom, can I go with you? And I said, of course, Dan. I want you to go with me. And so the two of us go out there, and we're swimming out. And it's a blue ocean. You've been to Hawaii, right? You know how blue it is. You're just swimming in blue. Everything's blue. You look up and you don't see anything. You know, I don't know. We don't see them. The whales, I don't know where they are. Don't know where John is. And we're just still heading out in the direction that they were. Little did we know, John passed us. He went by us. We never saw him. He went back to the boat. He had gotten the word and gone back to the boat. So we're still swimming out there. Now, whales, you know, they can be 50, 55 tons. They can do a full breach, get their entire body out of the water. Now, what do you think the accelerated speed is to get a 55-ton thing out of the water, totally out of the water? What's the accelerated speed you think they have to go? When I used to do, you know, works in engineering kind of corporations, I'd always ask them that, and they'd go back, and the next day they'd come up with all these answers, and no one really knew. But let's put it this way, fast. really fast, maybe 40 miles an hour, full speed, 80, you know, 60 foot long whale going that fast to get their whole body out of the water in a full breach. So that's how fast they can go. By the time you see them, they're through you, basically. So we're going out there, and all we see, Dan and I, is a cloud. You're that blue, blue water that you know what I'm looking at when you're a mile offshore in Hawaii. Everything's blue, and all you see is a darkness coming at you. And I can't mention it because we're talking speed here, but that's all you see. And it's already on top of you, so it seems. You think we were scared? Yeah. We were scared. We went from horizontal in the water. This is all we can, each of us, and Dan's in the water all the time with them as a researcher. Boom, went to vertical and just sort of grabbed each other. And in no time, and I mean no time, that's what it felt like, that whale went whoosh and stopped on a dime about 10 feet, no more, away from us with his eye, which is now about 3 foot, 10 feet away with the eye. The whole thing is gigantic, so you can't even see the gigantic nature of it, because all you see is the eye 10 feet away, stopping on a dime, looking right through us. Can you imagine what that felt like?
Yeah,
that's sheer power. I can't even imagine.
Sheer power. So what did we get from that? What's the learning from that? The learning is that I don't know anything. That's what I want you to get. Yeah. I, you, me, Dan and I in this moment got it. We don't know anything. Wow. If the world, the universe is that mind-blowingly significant, and we're trapped in our little egoic lives, and that just sort of ripped it right there, just a little peek into the universe of, yes, I know nothing. And this was the most peaceful experience of my life. From that sheer sort of terror moment, we're going to get run over by this dark shape, to stopping on a dime with this eye penetrating you. That was it,
That's crazy.
Don't know anything. Yeah. And you know, I mean, of all there is to know in this world, what do you and I know? So don't you think it's basically the thought is, don't you think it's rather silly to spend so much time trying to be so right about so little?
Right.
Yeah. So if I could imprint onto you what I got in that moment, is that message that can be so powerful when you're in some kind of conflict at home or work or whatever the damn thing is, the Trump Biden stuff, don't you realize?
Right.
That,
yeah,
it that we don't know, we don't know matter. Anything we let go yeah, you let go. We're that insignificant in this world. And Bucky Fuller used to say the same thing to us when he would come out as one of the Windstar advisors. You know, we had so many at Windstar, Bucky and Amory Lovins and Cousteau and David Brower, the Friends of the Earth, and Stuart Mace, and, Father Michael of the Monastery.
Yeah.
We had a bunch of guys that were phenomenal. And of course, Katzenberger, who was my guy ever since I brought him out from Connecticut or wherever, and Steve Conger, who was our architect at the time, and an amazing group of people. And basically, that kind of experience was the main instigator for Windstar in terms of John and I would say, hey, we need a piece of land so at least we can explore and bring people out and gather some of these people we have met, like Bucky Fuller, and just see what we can do. So I had done a meditation retreat. I used to lead those and I did one at this little retreat center that the monastery used. And I went out with John to walk the land because I knew Father Michael was interested in selling it. Father Michael was with us, and we had just gotten back from Hawaii in that experience I told you about, and we're walking the land, and it's beautiful out there. And Father Michael and the monastery needed some money, and blah, 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 blah. And then they showed us the site map of the land, and it looked just like a whale. And there was a pond on the land, and that pond was the eye of the whale in the perfect position. Are you there? Okay, you guys still yeah. still with me? Sometimes yeah. I just, I get rambling on and there's no one home. Kathy, no, up, it's just,
just reminds me of like Lizard Lake or something too, up at Marble.
Yeah, so it was a perfect shape. So we see the site map, and it is a whale, and we had just come back from that experience. So John said, he looked at me and said, done deal, I'm buying this, and that was great because the monastery needed the money, and that's so we had the land. And then over the next, this was in the late 70s, and then over the next 5 or 6 years that I was there anyway, we built all kinds of stuff. We built a big biodome. John Katzenberger was the lead man on that. I took this big structure that Steve Conger had designed, this 80-foot diameter structure, and put that up as my IKEA tent. And, we had biointensive gardens. We had a wind generator.
Yeah, I remember. I remember all that stuff. I remember when John was working on some of that stuff. It was pretty amazing. Yeah. He'd come to show us and tell us about what he was doing.
That's so great. Yeah. John is the best. I know in your book you had mentioned John.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, geez, they don't even know I taught at the community school back when it was at the physics center, and then I brought John out here as my assistant. It's like crazy.
Well, you know what's funny is the embodiment of spirit and character. My nephew embodies John Katzenberger. He works at a school that's very unique with students. He goes out rock climbing with the students, does special, takes them out with the van and does the whole thing. So he's very much a John Katzenberger-like character. And every time I see him, I think of John.
Yeah.